This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Democratic congressional candidate Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan says GOP claims of success with the tax bill are misplaced.
Working families are losing with that tax bill. The real winners there were corporations and the wealthiest 1%.
GLT's Ryan Denham talks with Dirksen-Londrigan about her campaign against incumbent Congressman Rodney Davis in the 13th District. Get an update from Normal's top cop on a body cam pilot project. The project is coming to an end, and Chief Rick Bleichner talks with Charlie Schlenker about what's next. And you'll meet singer-songwriter David Birchtold. He talks with GLT's John Norton just before his show at Night Shop tomorrow night. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's Monday, May 14th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from country financial representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Before there can be a blue wave, before it's really the year of the woman, Democrats like Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan have to win. Londrigan is the Springfield Democrat running against Republican Congressman Rodney Davis in the 13th District. That district includes parts of Bloomington Normal. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke to Londrigan about her surprisingly decisive primary win and what happens if Democrats retake the House in November.
Betsy, it's been just over a month since you won a five-way Democratic primary in the 13th Congressional District. What have you been doing for the past 44 days?
Still getting in front of voters and trying to, and also focusing on fundraising. You know, I know that it's going to take a lot of support to make sure that we can communicate our message to voters. And so making sure that we have the resources to do that is important.
I saw a photo of you recently with a few of the other Democrats who ran in the 13th Congressional District primary, Eric Jones, John Ebold, David Gill. What kind of relationship do you have with them at this point? I mean, it wasn't a particularly nasty primary battle.
Oh, no. No, we have a great relationship. John, Eric, and David are, I have enormous respect for each of them. And they have already, I mean, they immediately, you know, jumped on board and are committed to winning this district with me.
Well, Betsy, what are some things that you're learning about the differences between campaigning in the Democratic primary process versus campaigning in a general election over these last couple of months?
Pre-existing conditions don't pick political parties. Healthcare is an overarching concern for Republicans and Democrats alike. And there are a lot more areas that we have in common than not. You know, and people ask me, you know, what are your issues? What are you focusing on? And I can very honestly tell you that it's the voters' issues. You know, the voters are the ones who are telling me what our issues in the 13th District are. And it's healthcare, jobs, education, and it doesn't matter if you're Democrat or Republican. If you're sick and you need to go to a doctor, then that's what you need. And health care is important to all of us.
Well, another issue that's certain to be central to Congressman Davis's bid for reelection is the tax overhaul that passed right at the end of last year. Something that Republicans across the country are going to be running on is these tax cuts that they say they provided to middle-class Americans, in addition to the tax cuts that are going to companies and other folks. What is going to be your message on the tax overhaul?
You know, that middle-class working families are losing with that tax bill. The real winners there were corporations and the wealthiest 1%. And people know that. I mean, as I move around the district and listen to people, they know that the people who got the most help were corporations and the wealthiest. And they don't like that. You know, I believe we grow the economy from the middle class out. And I want to make sure that my focus in any tax reform is to helping middle-class families.
What are you hearing from potential voters out there about their perceptions of the health of the economy? I mean, you hear a message coming out from the White House and Congress about what they think it is and how healthy it is. What do you actually hear from people who are talking to you?
Well, you know, they want to make sure that we have a representative that first protects the jobs we have. And in our district, over a third of the jobs are tied into the healthcare and education systems. So making sure that I am protecting those and that I'm conscientious of those is a number one priority. And I can tell you that I am, and that I will protect those jobs. And in terms of, you know, of jobs and what they're seeing on the economy on a larger scale, you know, they're not buying the tax scam. They're not. They know that most of the corporations took advantage of it, you know, for buyback purposes and rewarding shareholders, that they are not seeing the fruits of that tax scam, which is why they call it a tax scam.
I want to fill in some blanks about your background. We've described you whenever we describe you on the air in sort of a shorthand. I think we call you a professional fundraiser from Springfield. Like, that's like the bare bones, right? But let's flesh that out. What are some things that you've done professionally that you think set you up for this job?
I'm a former middle school teacher. I loved teaching middle school. I was the first director of alumni affairs for the University of Illinois Springfield and got that program up and running when the University of Illinois took over Sangamon State and added that third campus. And I'm very proud of the work I did there. I've actually been self-employed for over 20 years. I have a background as a writer, as a graphic designer, web design. I've done a lot of things. And for the last 7.5 years, my primary contract has been with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation. And my job there was to make sure that we were promoting the legacy of Abraham Lincoln.
How long did you teach for, middle school?
2 years. But when I got the call from the University of Illinois, and they said, Betsy, we're taking over this third campus, and we would love for you to start the Alumni Association, bring the Sangamon State University graduates, you know, into the system and get us up and running. That was such a fantastic opportunity that I jumped. I'm a University of Illinois graduate, and I was very active with the Student Alumni Association when I was on campus, and so that's how that came to fruition.
So the gerrymandered, sprawling 13th district is very large, right? It's got all or part of 14 counties here in Bloomington-Normal.
It's a beautiful district.
It is beautiful, but it's big, right? It takes 2.5-3 hours to drive from one end of it to the other. This is a district that President Trump won by 5 points during the 2016 election. Mitt Romney narrowly won, I think, just by about a point with the 2012 election versus Obama. How does someone like you win in a district like this that so recently voted for President Trump?
You know, I think that right now there, you know, what we saw in the primary is that there was about a 30,000 vote swing. Typically, Republicans in the past have pulled about 20,000 ballots more than Democrats. We pulled over 8,000 more than Republicans in the primary. And I think that shows a great energy. And I think the issues that are on voters' minds, both Republican and Democrat, and the way that Congressman Davis has voted against the best interest of the district are really going to propel our campaign forward. Because, you know, I believe that health care is a right and not a privilege. And the voters in the district are scared of losing their access to health care. And they know that I'm committed to making sure that every corner of the district, that people have access to quality, affordable health care.
So a recent poll done for a Democratic outside group called Patriot Majority shows that Congressman Davis is leading you by just 3 points in this kind of initial hypothetical matchup that they did. Caveats galore here because it's a Democratic poll. But what did you take away from that and those numbers?
You know, that our message is resonating with voters, that they are, you know, that they are paying attention, that they know that if they want someone who's going to protect and fight for their health care, that they're going to pull a ballot for me. That if they want someone who is going to put the middle class first, then their vote is going our way. They want somebody, you know, my whole life pretty much has been invested in the 13th District. I've grown up in Springfield. I went to school at U of I. I've raised my own family here. And I'm bringing with me a whole life of experience to this race. I haven't been in a DC bubble. I've been right here in the district, invested in my community and in my neighbors. And I think that when people are voting for you, there's a little bit of a leap of faith that you really are going to keep their best interests at heart. And they know that I'm doing that and that I will continue to do that. I get around the district and stand in front of voters all the time. And I have put now probably, over 35,000 miles on my car getting around the district and doing just that. They want someone who will listen to them and then take their concerns to Washington, D.C., not the other way around.
The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has added you to its Red to Blue program, which sends additional resources to a handful of the 100 or more districts that the DCCC is targeting in November. So what does that actually mean for your campaign?
I think what it means is that they are highlighting our district and giving us a national spotlight, saying, here is a candidate and a campaign where we feel very strongly that this district can be flipped from red to blue.
What about tangible resources? Is it people? Is it direct money or just indirect money? What are the actual tangible things that your campaign receives?
Nothing tangible yet, but it's more that it is highlighting us and saying to people across the nation, hey, here's a race that you need to look at.
So time for hypotheticals, which is every candidate's favorite topic. A question I'm sure you've been asked out in the campaign trail is, if the Democrats were to retake the House in November, how aggressive do you think Democrats should be in investigating and perhaps even impeaching the president?
You know, I'll tell you, that's a question I only get asked on radio or, by interviewers. Voters don't ask me those things because that's not what's on their minds. I'll be taking my nod on priorities from the voters here in the district. And I can tell you what they want me to focus on is health care, good jobs, and education. That's where my priorities will be.
What are your feelings on whether Nancy Pelosi would continue to be Speaker if the Democrats were to retake the House?
Again, I will be taking my nod from the voters in the 13th District. You know, I don't know who's going to be up for Speaker. That's a big hypothetical. And what I want to do is make sure that whoever, I vote for, it has the best interests of the voters in the 13th district in mind, that they really will represent us.
There's a possibility that the next census will lead to one or more Illinois congressional districts to be eliminated due to changes in the population. This happened to Congressman Kinzinger, who actually grew up in this area, a Republican. He had to move, change districts in 2012, I think that was. Are you concerned that the 13th district may have kind of a short lifespan beyond this November's election, given what we're seeing with population changes in Illinois, particularly central Illinois?
You know, I have a hard time looking past, November of 2018. What I'm really focused on right now is making sure that the voters who are in the 13th district right now have a representative who listens to them and takes their concerns, to our nation's capital. That's where my focus is, frankly.
What about the 13th district itself? Now that you've spent so much time traveling across it, and you said it's a beautiful district, you've seen all the different corners and nooks and crannies of it. A district like that has always raised questions about gerrymandering and the way our political maps and boundaries are drawn. What are your thoughts now that you've spent so much time on the road putting 35,000 miles on your on your car, as you put it? What are your thoughts on redistricting and the way that process should go?
You know, I think in an independently decided upon map is the way to go. It needs to be reviewed independently.
That's GLT's Ryan Denham talking with 13th District Congressional candidate Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. To talk more politics, including the 13th Congressional District race, join GLT's Facebook group. Just search for Election 2018 in McLean County. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from The Fresh Market, offering prepared sides and grill-ready entrees for Memorial Day weekend, including burgers, kebabs, and marinated meat and seafood. Details and recipes available at thefreshmarket.com.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, get to know singer-songwriter David Birch, told he's playing Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. I'm Mike McCurdy. For about a year and a half, Normal Police have had a pilot program in place for body cameras. The department is coming to the end of that effort. Charlie Schlenker talks with Police Chief Rick Bleichner about full implementation of the Panasonic cameras now that the company has addressed battery life issues and concerns about the reliability of some of the features.
What we ended up, we knew that there was a new product coming out from Panasonic. Once that came out, we held off. And the reason we looked at Panasonic was because that's what our interview rooms are. That's what our in-car cameras are. We just spent about $200,000+ on that last year to upgrade all of our squad cars to that. So we felt if Panasonic had a viable body camera solution, It first of all, it simplifies all the data management. In the background, it takes care of a whole host of storage and linking of videos from the car to the person and meshing those all together that the officers don't have to worry about. And it provides us with some ease in we've got one vendor to go to when we've got problems or issues. So that was our benefit. If we could get that solution to work and it was workable for us, then we would move forward. If it wasn't, then we would look at other alternatives. And over time, what we found is that with the new products from Panasonic, some tweaking that we have done, the product seems to be very reliable. It seems to meet our needs at this point.
Battery life is okay.
Battery life is fine. So what we've done was there was some upgrades to the town's infrastructure system for their network that we were waiting on. That would allow us to have additional storage for body cameras. So we waited a little bit on that. That has been completed. We've placed the order for body cameras to outfit all of our patrol staff. We anticipate probably taking delivery of that in about 2 weeks. And then it will take some time to configure to get everything set up on the network, and then we'll start issuing those out. And we plan to issue them by shift so that the officers who have been involved in the pilot program can help and kind of be our trainers and problem shooters, if you will, problem solvers at the shift level. So we'll roll those out by shift. That also helps us manage any differences or changes with the program to make sure that it goes as smoothly as possible. And so hopefully by, I would say, late June, we should have it fully implemented across the department.
What did the pilot project turn up for common officer errors that can be tackled through education on the front end as you roll out the implementation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of it is just it's different. It's one of those things. There's a whole host of ways in which these cameras can be set up, some very simple, some very sophisticated.
Or in my case, technology that's not set up well at all.
Yeah. And our goal, from my standpoint, was it needs to be reliable. So when the officers turn it on, that it works. And that's the main thing. You don't want to have equipment out there that's not durable, that's not reliable. Because you're setting yourself up for failure. In this case, we felt through the pilot that the product was durable, it was reliable. We took officers' feedback throughout the pilot and made changes to how the body cameras were set up on our network, the difference of how the videos were downloaded, the speed in which they were downloaded. So, for example, there's an opportunity on this with the technology. It can download videos via Wi-Fi. Well, the problem is that if you have limited number of connecting points within the department, and you have not only the body cameras, but you have people's tablets and personal cell phones and any other devices that are trying to connect to that, it slows down the connection. So what we did was we simply turned that feature off, and we have charging banks in which the officers can drop the camera in. It quickly downloads the data. So within a matter of seconds, rather than taking minutes and sometimes up to an hour, depending on how long the video was to download, it's done in minutes, which makes it much more accessible. It's much more for operations anyway, it's much more efficient. So those were some things that we identified throughout the program, throughout the pilot. And, you know, in the course of it, I've seen agencies that have seen mass reductions in citizen complaints. We typically do not have a lot of citizen complaints. There have been a few times when we've had complaints, and that body cam video was critical in helping, you know, clarify that. What I have seen is for evidence gathering, for statements. For example, one of the, I guess, and it makes sense. We didn't think through this, but it makes sense that officers who are in the pilot program said it reduces their time on a particular call. In most cases, we'll cut it in half because in some cases, like a domestic call, you would go there, you would talk to the person, you'd separate the parties, you would get one side, you'd get the other side, and then you'd have to go back and do a recorded statement or take a written statement. Now, when the officer gets there, they say, you're being audio and video recorded. Tell me what happened. They catch all the emotion of the situation. They see any potential injuries. They've got the opportunity to photograph those with a feature that's on the camera. So what happened was, in a sense there, we've got a cost savings because it's saving time, and it improves officer safety because the less time that they're out on the scene is more safe for them, and it's more efficient. So that's one of the things that we've seen as a savings and a real benefit. Plus, in the use of force realms, it has really helped to document those situations where officers have had to overcome resistance by individuals, how quickly it happened, what occurred, the closeness of what happened. That has been very beneficial for us. Plus, the information going forward, if necessary for court, has been memorialized, and I know the state's attorney appreciates that.
How often have the cameras actually failed to record, mm-hmm. so that you maybe miss that domestic call?
Mm-hmm. There have been a couple of times in which there are malfunctions. We've got a report that officers, when it does not engage, there's a button on the front. We purposely didn't go with some of those sophisticated opportunities, like anytime you turn your light on, that could trigger the body camera. Some of them, when you open the door and exit the car, the camera comes on. We wanted to develop muscle memory so that it's an intentional action to turn the camera on and to turn the camera off. That way, you're not relying on technology that the officer, I think we've got a better chance of getting accurate video by doing that. But there have been a few times we've found some situations with some software glitches, with some firmware updates that were necessary. And what we've done with the program is that allows us to kind of pinpoint those cameras. I mean, right now we've got 6 to 8 that are out there, and before long we'll have 70 out there potentially. So we needed to get that piece of it down so that we could manage it. So it helps us. We may have a situation with that one particular camera that we can now take out of service, send in Panasonic and get serviced, or maybe something that our tech can do.
In going from 7 to 70 cameras, can you extrapolate? Have you thought about how many more calls for service you can answer by having that compression in the time per stop?
I think at this point, I mean, when I look at that, we look at our ratio of dedicated time to non-dedicated time, in other words, what would be discretionary patrol time, and we're in that 40 to 45% range, so where 55% of the time officers are not particularly detailed to a particular call. So I don't think we're at the point where that, certainly there will be some efficiency saved there. That would mean that, you know, obviously they can do some more discretionary patrols, things they want to do. But no, we think we've looked at it and we felt that I don't know. I don't have a number with what that's looked like. Again, I think that was something that was seems to be straightforward, but was kind of unattended. So obviously, the more time, the quicker they can get through those calls, the quicker they can get the reports done, and the quicker they can be back out on the street and available for that next call. So I don't have a hard number on that. But again, anytime in this day and age we can gain some efficiencies, it's certainly worth considering.
Rick Bleichner is Town of Normal Police Chief. He talked with Charlie Schlinker. Bloomington Police are rolling out their choice of a body cam this summer as well in a full department test run. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Equal Rights Amendment issue continues to boil in Springfield. Will it be called for a vote in the House? The Illinois Politics Roundtable isn't so sure. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Rachel Otwell, who covered last week's rallies.
Sure. So it's a perennial issue that's more so in the news now than since my time reporting over the last just, you know, several years. A resolution has made its way through the Senate and is stalled at the moment as supporters of the ERA seek to gain enough votes.
And the House has been where the problem has been, at least the last few times this has gone. They've gone through the Senate before. It was approved a couple of years ago, stalled in the House.
And actually right now, Steven Anderson, a Republican from Geneva, is working at getting votes together. He says the main opposition is saying that they're worried about permanently legalizing abortion or fears over bathrooms becoming gender neutral, that becoming the law of the land. So and that kind of narrative has been pushed by groups like the Illinois Family Institute, for instance.
Now, so there is some Republican support for this, Brian.
There is. And I mean, Steve Anderson is on his way out of the legislature. You might remember him as one of the ringleaders of the small group of Republicans who helped Democrats to finally end the two-year budget impasse last year. He has often been willing to go his own way on issues when he disagrees, with, the majority view in his party. And, you know, Charlie can speak to the history of this. The ERA has always made some interesting bedfellows, I think, in who supports it, who doesn't. Something that's important maybe for some of our younger listeners who weren't around in the early 80s covering the legislature. I mean, this has been an issue that goes back a long time. And there are questions whether if Illinois actually does finally ratify this amendment. We've passed the federal deadline set by Congress for states to ratify it. There's still another state that would need to ratify it. There are other states who have rescinded their ratification. So it's not clear that, I mean, this is not like the final piece of the puzzle before this would become part of the U.S. Constitution.
And Charlie, as Brian was mentioning, this has brought some different coalitions together in the past.
I think it's interesting. We hear the Republicans talk about all the bad things that are going to happen. Back in the day, one of the original co-sponsors of the resolution to ratify this amendment was a female legislator from DuPage County named Giddy Dyer. She and another woman legislator, Jeannie Chapman, from Arlington Heights, a Democrat, co-sponsored the resolution. They tried to carry it through the House back in the 70s without much success. There was a lot of what I would consider misrepresentation about what this was going to cause. And as a matter of fact, some of the arguments that we're hearing today are the same arguments that I heard 45 years ago.
Those go to things like women in combat, some of these issues that
yeah, well, guess what? We already have
right.
Women in combat.
So some things have changed through the time, but I guess that goes back, Rachel, to whether or not what is it accomplished by doing it? Because there are a lot of laws now that give women more access. So would it be, would it accomplish what people want to see with this?
Supporters say in Illinois, it's already in the state constitution. They're worried about the federal law of the land, and they say the ERA would elevate sex classification to the same scrutiny that's used for things like national origin and race and ethnicity.
And you had a chance to talk with somebody who is a relative, a daughter of Phyllis Schlafly, who led this fight against the ERA back in the 70s and 80s.
Ann Schlafly Corey is now chair of the Eagle Forum, which was started around the same time, I think in the 70s, that the ERA passed through Congress, and this was an issue. They call themselves a family rights group. One of their main focuses is on abortion. She is lobbying much in the same way that her mother did all those years ago. And Phyllis Schlafly made Illinois her battleground state. She lived here at the time and said, she went to the Capitol multiple times with her mother over this issue. Lobbyists were the ones baking pies for legislators, kind of just trying to promote the idea of, a good home life and, if women were to enter the workforce, et cetera, more so that would be bad for family units. But Ann Schlafly, Corey, brought up the draft thing that her mother had pushed. She brought that up saying that there would have to be exact equal numbers of women as men in the military, for instance, which, that's quite debatable. And again, I think abortion is really a sticking point here for those
who
are against
it. And I would say this idea that, there's got to be the same number as men as women. Are there the same number of people of color in the military as are Caucasians?
Right.
Because if it's a question of being treated equal, as you said, this says you can't discriminate based on somebody's gender. Well, we now say you can't discriminate based on race, but that doesn't mean that there's absolute parity, right?
Well, can somebody tell me why this is getting so much attention now? Because certainly this has been a fight that's been going on. Some people have been waging this battle for decades. Why right now? Why does it seem to be picking up so much steam right now?
I think in the wake of the Me Too movement, there's a lot of analysis I've read that kind of chalks it up to that. Our president is someone who has made disparaging comments against women. People who maybe thought this was already part of our Constitution, especially people who are maybe 30 years old and younger. Some people are appalled to know that it's not already part of the Constitution. So I think kind of this sea change that we're noticing when it comes to women's issues, more openly addressing problems in our society, the ERA is kind of, it's gained some steam due to those efforts.
Rachel Otwell and Brian Mackey are reporters for IPR. Charlie Wheeler heads the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield. And Sean Crawford moderated the Illinois Politics Roundtable on Sound Ideas. If you're looking for a real challenge, don't climb a mountain or run a marathon. Try not driving in a community designed for cars. Could you do it or drive less? Registration is open for the Good to Go Commuter Challenge. On the line, your health, the environment, your budget, and the chance to win a $25 Visa gift card daily or a $200 gift card at the end. All you have to do is not drive alone. Carpooling works, and so do bikes and buses. Are you good to go? The challenge is May 14th through the 20th. Register at goodtogomclean.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time, supporting arts and culture, youth engagement, employment, career development, and more. More information about the impact you could have at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Kids and broccoli, kids and homework, kids and opera. One of these three things actually do pair well together, so long as the performers are spirited and the story is fun. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Prairie Fire Theater has teamed up with Illinois Wesleyan University theater students to produce an original children's opera. Written by Nancy Steele Brokaw, Baobab is set in the land of La Bella Luna, a kingdom that has existed in peace for thousands of years, with a tree at the heart of the kingdom, a tree called Baobab.
And what happens is one day, Dubuque Lacrosse
Zuta Lors.
It's Bob Mangiliardi, the funniest bad guy baritone ever, sails in with his hapless tenor assistant Smoot with a treasure map and a clue and a gleam in his eye. He decides incorrectly, by misreading a lot of clues, that Baobab contains in its heart a magic wand. And so he sets out to chop down this ancient sacred tree. There are two girls on the island who are the latest generation in the ancient order of tree keepers, and it's their job to protect Baobab. But the question is, are they up for the job? And the other question is, can Smoot rise to the occasion and stop Dubuque Lacrosse? These are all questions we ask and eventually in a riotous conclusion get answered. The Prairie Fire Theater Illinois Wesleyan Children's Touring Opera started 15 years ago. Bob started it, and I think they went to one place. And it's grown and grown, and this is the eighth one I've written, and we actually have, unbelievably, 47 gigs in the next 3 weeks. And it grows out of a conviction that kids deserve to know and hear live theater and the beautiful music of Mozart, Rossini, Puccini, the works of Gilbert and Sullivan, live and in their school. And with school budgets cut to the bone as they are, especially in the arts, they just simply would never get that opportunity. And we think that music belongs to everyone. So it comes out of that conviction.
So the story of Baobab, are you trying to convey an environmental message with this?
Absolutely, we are. One of the questions we ask is, are ancient trees worth fighting for, or big trees worth fighting for? Baobab represents natural resources. It provides food and shelter and fiber and all these things to the islanders. And what happens when that's destroyed? So, yes, that is a question we ask.
Well, the audience, of course, gets to enjoy a live performance, but what else do they get?
Well, we do a lot of audience participation. This year, we have a kind of a hand motion for Ancient Order of the Tree Keepers that the kids will do. And for years, when whoever Bob's bad character is, he'll say, "I am Dubuque Lacrosse. I am the bad guy." And the kids go, "Wah, wah," you know, every time he says it. And they go wild. And that really gets them involved in lots of ways in the story. And then we actually have some clues to how to write your own stories this year written in, which they'll read aloud. And then at the end of the show, we always have three kind of lessons that they've learned. And the kids will read those too. And this year it's trees are magnifique, it's important to be brave, and it helps to be prepared.
Well, of course, you'll be taking this to school for kids to enjoy, but what about grown-ups? Do you have any grown-up gigs?
Yes, because it is a great show for grown-ups, too. It's so funny. And the music is just glorious, you know, beautiful music well sung. We have six public performances this year. We will be Normal Public Library, May 19th at 10 a.m. in the community room, and then that afternoon at 2 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church. And then on Tuesday, May 15th at 6:30, we'll be at the Bloomington Public Library. And then this is new for us. Wednesday, May 23rd, we'll be at the Normal Theater for three performances at 10, 1, and 2. And it's free of charge, and we'd love for people to come and see what we're doing.
That's Nancy Steele Brokaw, author of the new children's opera, Baobab, staged throughout this month by Illinois Wesleyan University theater students and Prairie Fire Theater. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The show's sets are designed by John Stark, who is also the artistic director of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival and the guy who hired Nancy Steele Brokaw to write this year's Theater for Young Audiences play for the festival. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. Central Illinois-based singer-songwriter David Birchtold says he didn't know Piedmont blues was a thing, even though the style has influenced his style. Ahead of his appearance at Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night, Birchtold brought his guitar to the GLT studios and gave John Norton a short tutorial on the historic style of guitar playing.
Yeah. It's funny, when my kid was teaching himself how to play guitar or ukulele, you know, and one of the first things you start picking out, you know. Yeah.
I just taught that to a student. I'm starting to give lessons, too. Can I say that on the air?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Okay. You're a Piedmont finger-picking, infused blues, folk, roots, and regs.
That's correct.
Guitarist, artist, singer, songwriter. It's on your website.
Yeah.
I always associated Piedmont with blues. Is that an accurate
statement?
That's
absolutely correct. Piedmont is a blues style. It's based on the southeast coast, the Carolinas, and that area. It's an interesting style. It's a funny story. I didn't even know I was playing Piedmont until I did a show at Dixon Mounds Museum, Chris Filillo's venue down there. They have a Hickory Ridge Coffee House. And I did a concert down there, and in the middle of the concert, we took a break, and he said, "Man, you got that Piedmont style down pat," and I didn't even know it. And so I started doing some research, and sure enough, the stuff I'm playing is Piedmont blues. It's the standard blues is like, that's your Chicago lump blues, but
sure.
Piedmont is more, it's got an alternating thumb, and it's more melodic, so it's like a... So you got an alternating thumb going, and your treble fingers are doing the melody. It's a nice full sound, and it's just fun to play.
So is it kind of a ragtime or rag morphing into that a little bit?
A little bit. There are some Piedmont players that do ragtime. Blind Blake was Piedmont. Blind Willie Johnson. Big Bill Brunsey was accused of playing Piedmont, even though he was from Chicago.
Okay.
Mississippi John Hurts.
Was he a Piedmont?
Not really.
Right?
His stuff is more country blues.
Okay, all right, yeah.
But country blues and Piedmont are you could play both, and they can pass for each other, sort of.
So you didn't even know you were playing Piedmont when you were playing Piedmont. So I was going to ask you, is like, you know, how did you get introduced to this music? How did it just hit you? And it sounds like kind of on the blind side.
Yes, I can thank Chris Villillo for that at Hickory Ridge.
So when he told you that, then what happened? What clicked in your mind?
Well, I went back and started doing some research, and sure enough, I found several of the songs I were doing were Piedmont artists. And then I started looking around. There's a couple of Piedmont artists that we can thank Pink Floyd's band name for. Pink Anderson and Floyd Council are both Piedmont blues artists, and they were listening to that stuff in the early days when they formed the band, and that's how they got their name, Pink Floyd.
So you were hearing other songs, possibly, and that's kind of what you disincorporated, or did you kind of reinvent it yourself?
Well, it's kind of, my style just kind of blended into that before I even knew what Piedmont was, and then I started looking it up and researching the artists and playing some of their stuff. Blind Blake, I play his song, Police Dog Blues, is pretty Pat Piedmont. It's an open D blues.
Is that something you could give us a quick sample of?
I could. I learned this song before I even knew it was Piedmont. It's off one of my all-time favorite albums, Hot Tuna, which is Jorma Kaukonen, who was the lead player for Jefferson Airplane.
And you've met him and worked with him.
I have. I've been to his workshop.
Well, let's talk about that after the song.
All right, cool.
Okay.
Yeah, so I knew of this song years and years before I knew it was Piedmont. Hmm. And then when I heard it was Piedmont, I said, well, let's learn it. And so I basically worked up Jorma's version, and I got my own flavor to it. But it sort of goes like this. All my life, I've been a traveling man. All my life, I've been a traveling man. Staying alone, doing the best I can.
Blind Blake. By David Birchtold. Here in the GLT studios, this is Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. David Birchtold is playing Night Shop in downtown Bloomington on the 15th. This is exciting. Get you downtown at the Night Shop.
That's right. I'm really looking forward to that. Nice early show. So playing 6 to 9 and have good food there. Sit down at a table, enjoy some good music and some good food.
Well, right before that little selection, you mentioned Jorma Kaukonen, the former Jefferson Airplane legend, who was a heck of a finger picker himself, right?
And, absolutely.
And did you go to a camp with him? Did you go to a festival with him? Where did you meet him?
Yeah, well, he formed this camp down in the foothills of Ohio, the Appalachian foothills down in Ohio. It's right near Athens, Pomeroy, Ohio. And it's basically just a finger picking guitar camp. And what he does is you go down there for 4 days, and you get about 10 hours of workshops with Jorma and about between 6 and 10 students. It's great, great personal instruction. And Jorma's a funny guy. He's got stories like you wouldn't believe what he can remember. And he's upfront about that. I've been down there 4 times and learned some great stuff. One of my fond moments of being down there was they had the student performance every time. And, of course, you get up and play stuff you've been working on or stuff you just know really well. And I asked Jorma if he would play lead on one of my songs, and he did. I got a song called Serenity. It goes like this. And it goes on, and practiced it once, and Jorma said, okay, I'm ready. And then we got up on stage, and he just played a very cool lead over it.
Well,
that was fun.
Was there anything, you mentioned that he gave you some help. Do you remember a tip or two that he gave you?
Absolutely. One of the things that he said is the groove is all important, no matter what you do. And everybody who plays live has this happen. You get lost every once in a while. You go to a wrong chord or whatever. And the worst thing you can do is stop and swear. I actually did that my first show. So we've learned a lot since then. But he holds up his thumb. Jorma held up his thumb and he said, this is the groove right there. No matter what happens, you keep that thumb going. Mm. And I tell you, that saved my butt many, many times.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The voice you're hearing is David Birchtold. He brought his guitar with him as well. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. I want to go back to the whole Piedmont blues idea, all right?
Sure.
Piedmont blues inherently a solo or duo act?
You know, that's a good question. It is more or less a solo thing. You don't hear, it's such a full style of playing. that it doesn't lend itself to a band very, very well. When you start getting all those instruments, then you got to simplify what you're doing or it gets lost in the mix.
Okay. You want to play another? Can you play an original?
Oh, yeah. It's not Piedmont, or I can do a Piedmont if I retune it.
No, that's fine.
All right. This little thing called A Major Jam. It's alternating thumb with the melody, so it kind of qualifies as Piedmont, although it's not quite bluesy enough, I don't think. But this is one I wrote before I knew about Piedmont, and it still qualifies pretty much.
Okay.
It's called A Major Jam, not because I was on a head trip or anything. It's just in the key of A major. It goes like this.
I really liked it. That's cool, Dave. You wrote that.
Thank you. Yeah.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. David Burchtold in studio. He's at Night Shop on the 15th in downtown Bloomington. And just a couple more questions.
Sure.
You said the A major jam is not really a blues. It probably doesn't qualify as a blues. Do you consider yourself a blues purist?
Well, no, because...
Where do you fall on that line?
Well, people ask me what kind of style I play, and I don't have an answer because I play everything except country and rap. I mean, it's folk, blues, roots, ragtime. I do some gospel, instrumental music. Love Leo Kottke, John Fahey, Reverend Gary Davis has some absolutely wonderful instrumental stuff.
Oh, yeah, he was so good. Rory Block has covered, has come out an album with the Reverend Gary Davis.
Yeah, I've been to her workshop at Fur Peace Ranch.
Really?
Yeah, and it was actually a... It was a Reverend Gary Davis workshop, and she also taught some Robert Johnson stuff, which I haven't worked up yet.
That's a good point. I've never really asked anybody, what made Robert Johnson so special as a player? Because he's this huge mythical figure in blues, but as a player itself, what do you take from Robert
Johnson? Well, my take from that is he kind of invented that, as far as I know. I mean, there might have been people that he learned from, but the style that he plays in was not heard before he did that and recorded it, as far as I know. It was amazingly percussive and amazingly intricate in places, and he could go from playing fantastic lead work to a groove that was just killer, and nobody was really doing that the same way he did it at the time, and he influenced every blues picker that ever lived to a certain extent.
Even yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Well, David Burchtold, it's great to have you in studio. This is fun.
Pleasure to be here.
You got one more song? Yeah, maybe another original to take us out here?
I sure do.
Okay.
Like I said, I do a lot of Leo Kottke. So this song came up as a result of the fact that I do a Leo Kottke tune called Busted Bicycle. It kind of goes like this. And it goes on and on and on. Great tune. And you have to tune to open C for that, which is just the weirdest tuning I use. It's got the lowest note I use and... One string actually goes up, so it's just a bizarre tuning. I have to tune just for that one song, and I thought, well, let's not waste the tuning. So I came up with I wrote a song in open C. I call it Tree Frog Tickle. It's sort of a tribute to my my older brother who passed away from COPD a few years ago. That's how cigarettes get you if you don't have cancer.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thank you. It's okay. He was a great guy and a lot of good memories. And so his nickname was Tree Frog. It's Birch Told. Birch tree, told, toad, birch toad, tree frog. Anyway, and so this is called Tree Frog Tickle.
Listening to David Burchtold play his original song, Tree Frog Tickle, in the GLT studios, he spoke to GLT's John Norton for Sound Ideas.
Frog Tickle. It's David Birchtold. He plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. Discover more local music and hear from local artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from John Norton, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.